Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
Hi, Dr. Redmond.
And we've got the three episodes that deal with the aftermath of Roswell, New Mexico to go through. So this should be a ride.
And very clearly you're right, so.
Okay, I'm glad you saw it right away.
Well, but I saw something else that was really funny.
Well, there's going to be a lot to talk about that's really funny.
But, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, after I finished watching these three episodes, I'm going, oh, Sheila, you're probably
overthinking
this. But I tell you, so we'll get there.
Okay, now I'm really excited to see what you spotted. It's going to be great. All right, let's get to it, though, with 13, seriously? Wow. Okay. I just didn't notice that it was a 13-13.
Well, you know, consider that we're not superstitious, so we're okay.
No. Yeah.
And given the number of 13s.
Oh, God, yeah. No, you're right. And the whole year is 13s.
Yes.
Season 13. Yes. It was never going to go well. All right, so hit us with the synopsis, s'il vous plaît.
Cure. When a businessman in Washington, D.C. is stabbed to death in his office and a mysterious cryptogram is found lodged in his throat, the BAU sets out to catch a serial killer determined to eradicate institutions of power. Meanwhile, J.J. grows concerned after receiving an email asking her to sit down with Assistant Director Linda Barnes. All I can say is Kim Rhodes.
Yeah. Well, she was, it's nice to know that this was actually a returning character from, Beyond Borders.
Yeah,
like, because they talk about her shutting down the Beyond Borders team. And, of course, the first time I saw this, I had no idea they were talking about a real episode of television. Like, that didn't occur to me for a second. But, you know, it's not a surprise. It's just nice. It's nice that yes, we have actually seen this character before, theoretically. If you watched terrible show, Criminal Minds, Suspect Behavior.
No, Beyond Borders.
Beyond Borders. Oh, my God. I got to stop. I got to stop doing that. It's tough, though. Like, you think spinoff and you think of the good spinoff. It's not that crazy what I'm doing. All right. Let's get to it. First things first. So they see the Aselpus. Is that how you pronounce it?
No.
The thing that's not Codicus. Aselpus?
No, Asclepius.
Asclepius, right? And what bothers me is
Asclepius.
Asclepius, thank you.
Thank you.
So what bothers me here, and it's a very silly thing to jump out at, but I'm going to stand by it, is the casual drive-by claims of superiority by Spencer Reed, where he refers to on the wall, it looks like an attempt to render Asclepius. I'm like, that's a pretty great drawing. There's a staff, there's a snake wrapped around it, and it's obviously a snake. How is that an attempt to render? That's just a drawing of Asclepius.
Asclepius.
Asclepius. I don't think it matters how I pronounce it. So I'm going to keep doing it wrong. No, I'm not. It's fine. But isn't that a crazy thing for him to say just in passing?
Well, it's so picayune in a complaint, but yeah, you know, I mean, it was a very clear drawing.
Yeah, like I knew right away what I was looking
at,
and I think everyone would. So why is he doing this whole, oh, well, that might be a rendering of Asclepius. Haha, I got it.
Because Christopher Barbeau and everybody in the writing room didn't know what that was a picture of. So they figure the whole world doesn't know what that is a picture of.
Or it's a situation where, like, the production staff did a better job than the writer was expecting. And just really clearly drew the thing. And then they're like, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to change the line. But it's like, you don't even have to say. You can just say, he's drawn Asclepius. You don't have to say, like, change the wording if the wording doesn't make sense, guys. We say this all the time. Second thing, and this is me being a nerd, that was embarrassing. That looks nothing like a Batleth. Nothing at all.
Nothing at all like a Bat-Leth.
Nothing at all like a Bat-Leth. So, Bat-Leths have two sides.
Yes.
And a middle part that's like a sword guard in the middle. So there's, it's, their spaceships are actually shaped a lot like their swords. So it's got two wings, you hold it in the middle, and then it's got a part that comes out to guard your hands and catch enemy blades. That's what a Bat-Leth looked like. Klingon daggers are just straight out daggers that have like jagged parts that pop out. What that knife is, as mentioned in the show, it's a knife that is used in Silat, an Indonesian martial art. And they mention that in the show, but you could have had, if you wanted to have a nerdy character say something, have the nerdy character say, oh, like in The Raid, because 3 years before this movie came out, there was a movie, no, 4 years before this movie came out, there was a movie called, this episode came out, there was a movie called The Raid about a bunch of guys doing Silat in a building, and it's what made everyone aware of Silat and those knives. So it's just like, that's the reason this knife is in this episode, and that's the reason the teenager would have it. So maybe the fact that it's a knife from this movie helps their profile of it being a friggin' teenager who's committed the crimes. Because he's the kind of guy who would have been 13 years old when that movie came out and been really impressed by the cool knives in that movie. And it would help them wrap their head around the fact that it's a young and immature murderer.
Well, number one, although if, yeah, I mean, they did find out what that knife was. Okay, yeah. The writing room. Remember, they all do their own research.
That's true.
And obviously, Christopher Barbour does not watch Star Trek, and neither does anybody else in the writing room.
It's just so weird to have him do the Star Trek call out when it's clearly not a Star Trek knife.
Yeah, you know, it's like, say, like, you know, you just kind of look at it. What, are you saying that girls who follow Star Trek are stupid?
Yeah, like they can't recognize?
I don't think so. I, you know, it's like, what is this? I mean, we're picking on this, all of these little things in this this episode, right? Because it's...
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great episode, but I just think it's, they get every, like... This episode is full of fiddly little details, and I think it's important to mention that they get all of them wrong. Like, yeah. How they, the show's complete, completely incorrect depiction of how code breaking works.
Like, well, now, let me tell you, Glenn please. Kershaw, one of the defendants in the lawsuit, directed yeah. this episode.
Oh, weird.
Just thought I'd throw this. Whenever we start seeing problems... Like, all I can do, keep going, oh, yeah, okay,
well,
so.
Well, maybe they were distracted. Yeah, maybe they were distracted maybe, this whole
and not
year.
Paying enough attention
to the details,
what was going
yeah.
on in the details, yeah.
I mean, it's possible, because it's like, so they get this note out of the guy's throat, right?
Yeah.
And then they go, they get the note out of the guy's throat. And they go and they look it over, and they start doing some nonsense. So they talk about how it's the Zodiac's code. Oh, please, you were saying.
No, there's just some stupid little thing, but I'll say it right now and then you can
go on. Yeah,
no,
that's what I'm saying. So jump in.
So they keep using the same coroner's office.
Yeah, they do.
They've used that two or three times before, and they don't even make any attempt anymore to kind of disguise it. You just
Although this time they are in Maryland, so there would be a good reason for them to be going to the same place. But you're right. They've used it when it was San Francisco, too. Yeah, they're not doing as good a job as disguising it as they used to.
No,
you're absolutely
no.
right.
No.
But anyway, the point I was getting at was, wow, you derailed me for once. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thumbs up. Seriously, though.
Let's go back to the Zodiac.
No, so they go to the Zodiac and they're like, oh, well, we'll just decode, except this guy has used letters from four different alphabets. So, you know, and then they start talking about shift value. But the thing is, if it's a Caesar code, the way Caesar code works is, so Caesar is +3. So you look at a group of letters, right? And then, so A becomes D, because it's +3. Or you can do Caesar -5, so A would become, I'm bad at counting backwards in the alphabet.
Two.
I want to say
two.
V. Let's say ZYXWB. It is V. All right, I was right. Okay. Yeah, so A would become V, or so on and so forth. That is how a Caesar code works. But the problem is, you can't do a Caesar code if you have a giant wall of not letters. Right? Like, you have to figure out what words those, what letters those symbols stand for before you can do the Caesar code. Because if you've got a bunch of gibberish on screen, you would have to know which of those is A, B, C, D, so-and-so. And here's the problem. If you can only do a figure out a transposition code, if the message is written out in regular letters on the other side of the transposition. Right? If on the other side of the transposition, you've got gibberish, because it's been Caesar coded, you will never figure out that code unless you're told what the symbols mean. So if I, let's say I write the letter, I write the, right? So that's T, oh, sorry, actually, I'll do a fun thing. So let's say I write IBM, right? And I've used a Caesar code of -1 and switched that to how. Fun fact, that's why HAL is called HAL in 2001, is because it's one letter up from IBM, each one. So now, Caesar code -1, I've written the word HAL. Now I replace HAL with a smile emoji, a dog emoji, and a cake emoji. So the H is smile, A is dog, L is cake. The thing is, there is no force on earth that can get you to understand that I wrote IBM. Unless you can figure out that the first one is how. They talk about it like it's a Caesar code, but it isn't. It's a transposition code. And they talk about using a net letter shift, like in Caesar codes, but until you find out what the characters mean, you can't do a shift. And if the shift, if like the characters are represented a shifting thing, you'll never figure out what the characters mean, because the only way to solve a transposition code is to look for common letter groups. The Zodiac thing was famously cracked because the two people who cracked it figured out that he was going to write kill a bunch in this letter. So they looked for two letters next to each other. And so those two letters are going to be two L's. And so if the letter before it is the same bunch place, that's going to be an I. And then before that is going to be a K. And once you've got K, I, and L, you can start figuring out the rest of the words. So yeah, like, the way they talk about this code, as someone who is read up on and is very interested in code breaking, is complete nonsense, and has nothing to do with how codes are made or codes are solved. And it's like, you'd think with a guy from the FBI working in the office, someone could have told them that, but nobody did.
Yeah, but the thing is that even if you've got a guy working in the office, he probably doesn't know anything about cryptograms and codes, because code breaking in and of itself, right? And I mean, the reason they use so many women as code breakers is that women do tend to be very good at code breaking for whatever reason, right? But that's just a shout out.
Talk about the Bletchley Circle ladies.
Yes, Bletchley Circle, which is a show I should suggest sometime.
Oh, I'm sure you will.
Yeah, a mysterious cryptogram. Yeah, the cryptograms are fun to do, but they can be really, really hard. And then if you add, like, it's really hard to crack a cryptogram if it doesn't use a substitution code.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway.
Add a substitution code, it becomes impossible.
And then you want to, unless you know what the substitution is. And that's how spies work, right? Yeah. And so you have to try and figure it out, and that gets more difficult. And then when you add three different languages, the characters from three different languages
for the code.
You just sort of sit there and go, okay, yeah, you guys don't know anything about what you're talking about, but what the hell, you know, so what else is new?
I mean, it would be one thing if the three different languages, right, he just used, like, whatever the Cyrillic equivalent of his S to be S, whatever the Arabic equivalent of A to be A, then this would be 100% solvable. But there's no suggestion that that is what he did. Because we're not told that he used the characters to represent the exact letter in the Roman alphabet that they're equivalent to. If they had said that, it's solvable, sure.
Okay, but if you were creating a cryptogram, why would you do that? Because that's easy to figure out.
Unbelievably easy to solve. Yes.
You know, so.
It's weird that you're right. It's this strange situation where either the thing is incredibly easy to solve, because you can go to the internet right now and just type in Caesar code, and there's this thing that'll decode Caesar code stuff for you without you having to do the work. Right? So you just have to say plus whatever, and then the program does the Caesar code for you. It's fantastic. I've used it in video games all the time. Yeah. Caesar codes come up a lot in video games. And it's just to save myself some time. But my point is, if they just gave him a Caesar code, the Caesar code thing, then it's the easiest puzzle in the world. But if the characters weren't one-to-one comparisons to their Roman versions, then it's the hardest code in the world that can't be solved. So it's either a stupidly easy puzzle, or it's an impossible puzzle.
Yeah.
And the show doesn't know which is which.
It's okay.
It's very frustrating.
We all know that Merlin and Sir Galahad,
yes, they're going to solve it, of course. It's their quest.
Yes, it's their quest. I'm terrible. I'm getting really, really
frustrated with that.
Well, no, I'm just being very, very sort of cynical and nasty.
I get it.
About this show these days. That's what I thought after I finished these three episodes to myself. I'm going,
you're getting mean.
Oh yeah. Anyway. Okay.
Well, this show's put us through a bunch.
Yes.
Okay, so they decide it's very immature writing. And so the teenager must be responsible for the crime. Seems a bit of a stretch, but okay. And then the craziest thing happens, and I'm sure you noticed this too and were freaked out by this too. Like, David Rossi has this bizarre monologue, how he talks about how, like, they're trapped in the shadow of the night. I'm like, what are you talking about? What is with the ornate purple prose, David Rossi? You've never talked like this before in the history of the show. And you suddenly decided to be poetic? It flies in the face of everything we know about this character. What are you doing?
The game is afoot. His game. With us. He may profile as a hybrid of the Zodiac Killer, the Unabomber, but something tells me his real motive lies somewhere else. And until we know what it is, this unsub will remain in the shadow of the night.
So, okay, I'm glad you agree with me on this one, because I thought I might have been going out on a limb.
I'm sorry. I can't stop laughing.
No, it's bad. Like, it is bad. It doesn't make any sense at all that he's talking like this suddenly. Oh, my God.
Well, they're now seeing the other side of David Ross.
I know.
That makes all of these women fall in love with him. How's that?
There you go. He loves his drama.
Oh,
I know. It's crazy that he talks like this suddenly. What are you doing, David? Come on. You're supposed to be a cop. We're supposed to be able to take you seriously. And suddenly, no, you can't take this man seriously anymore. But yes, it's a bizarre scene when they're there in the decoding room and he's like, just starts rambling about nonsense. I'm like, David, what is happening? How are you? You know people can hear you, right? Oh, God. It was, it's a bad scene. So basically, they spend the whole episode waiting around with no idea who did it until... It's weird, because it's an ABC Murders type situation where the guy wants to kill a bunch of people so he can kill his dad without anyone knowing. By the way, I've just spoiled the plot of the ABC Murders. Sorry about that, if you haven't read that Poirot novel. Wonderful Poirot novel.
Oh, by the way, there's a really good version of the ABC Murders with John Malkovich as Poirot.
What? Seriously?
Yes.
All right, well, I know what I'm watching tonight. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. Like, I think it might have been done as a... It's about six episodes, I think.
Oh, really? So a miniseries?
It's not a movie. Yeah, it's a miniseries.
Wow. All right. Well, all right. I'm looking into this.
Because I just finished watching it.
It's also a very, there's also a very good, weirdly, video game version of it. That, like, does a really good job of turning it into a detective game where you just play as Poirot. It's very entertaining and I liked it a lot. But yes, one of my favorites. I love Poirot generally. ABC Murders is an amazingly good story. And that's what he's doing here. He's committing an elaborate serial killing to hide one crime. That's the plot of the ABC Murders, spoiler alert. But hey, I didn't tell you who.
No!
I didn't tell you who did it.
Yeah.
So there you go. But yes, the ABC Murders, it's a very interesting, and I mean, it's a plot that happens over and over again in fiction and with serial killer stories. They've done it here on the show a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and it's a pretty normal story.
It's a solid type of story.
So literally until they get to the guy who he's actually there to kill, they have no idea what's happening. And you can say that it's important that they profiled that the guy was fairly immature in his writing as a way to get it to a teenager, which is nice. Right? I liked that. But by and large, they solved this one just because it's pretty obvious that there's only one suspect once the guy's dad gets stabbed. Well, there's very few people who wanted that guy dead. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense to go after his son. And then the show takes a weird... the team is incompetent, hateful, also hateful, and kind of misogynistic turn, where instead of the third victim getting rescued, a woman has to be punished for breaking up a marriage. And so, a woman, and this is literally what happens in the episode, and the first time I watched it, I couldn't believe it, and it gets worse. Because this man goes to stab his father, and he gets interrupted because the father's girlfriend is in his house. And he looks right at this witness to his crime who just saved his victim, and then he runs away. And then the cops aren't like, hey, maybe we better look after that woman.
Yeah.
The killer has seen her. The killer has a reason to want to kill her. Maybe we provide her some protection until this is all wrapped up. Like, I feel like they probably should have. I feel like that should have been a pretty high priority, but no, that doesn't occur to them at all, because the show immediately shows up, kind of blames her, again, blames her obviously for breaking up a marriage, so decides, well, she's expendable. This woman's gotta go. And so, yeah, she gets, spoiler alert, she gets killed in an unusually unpleasant murder for this show. Like, she gets clubbed in a parking lot and dumped in the basement of a warehouse, stabbed to death. I'm like, that's the ending you guys went with? Because, and by the way, this is the crazy part. In an episode, an episode after this, in which they're going through all of the stuff the team has failed to do, like all the ways they've failed, the fact that this woman got killed because they didn't bother protecting a witness to a crime doesn't even come up. Like, nobody remembers this happened a week later. Really bothered me.
Well, yeah, but it was a different writer, right? For the next two stories, right? So why would they pay attention to the story that was written before?
Yeah.
I'm just being, you know.
No, I know. You're just devil's advocating this one. And in this case, we apparently think of the writers of Criminal Minds as devils. You get to follow that analogy to its natural endpoint.
Well, I mean, at some level, Here's my problem. At some level, I could feel sorry for the writing room and the rest of them, but all of these friggin' people knew what was going on.
Yeah.
On this set. And I think I can't get over being really pissed off about that.
Yeah. No, it's
that
hard.
They all did. And JJ and Spencer. I mean, all of these people, you know, all of these actors and actresses knew what was going on in this set, and they all basically ignored it, covered it up. So, okay, never mind. Okay, now?
Okay. All right. You got that out of your system. You're going to be able to look away from that for the rest of the thing. Okay.
No, good. I won't, but we'll get there.
I know you won't, but you're going to try. you're going to try. And that's, do we ever ask you more than that you try? I don't think we do.
All right.
So let's continue to the end of the episode, which is just a throw off line where they completely misrepresent the only positive relationship in the history of the, like the only good relationship in the history of the show. Where they talk to JJ about, like, JJ's talking about how, you know, rough it is that they did manage to save that woman, and it's tough when stories end this way, blah, 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 blah. And then she, and then Emily's like, you know, there's stuff you can't take home, so if you want to talk about it. And I'm like, no, she 100% can take this home. She's the only one of you, of all of you, in a healthy, stable, supportive relationship. She can take this stuff home and deal with it healthily with her husband. Like, it's you who go back to an empty house and a cat and a lot of booze.
Yeah.
Like, by comparison, JJ is a much more stable person in a much more stable personal situation. Yep. So yeah, like, don't give me this, you can't take some of this home. She absolutely can. You're projecting, Emily.
Yes.
That's what's happening here. You're projecting.
You all want right. someone to talk to take it exactly. home, too.
Exactly. But she can't yeah. admit that, so she has to externalize this stuff. So yeah, just, you know, another thing where Emily, not always the greatest person. But yeah, it's a frustrating episode because they get the decoding stuff so wrong. They don't bother protecting a witness. And as usual, they're just kind of, you know, completely at a loss for what's going on until a clue kind of just drops into their lap. But yes, that happens every week.
Yeah. And then we have to just mention that JJ has received the email and
sat down
with Linda Barnes,
yeah,
the assistant director. And of course, what's his face? You know, from Beyond Borders.
Matt.
Matt is, you know, Tariff, you know, is just making everybody absolutely paranoid about what's going to go on.
Oh, exactly.
Because this woman is Satan in a female disguise and is going to destroy the BAU the way she destroyed Beyond Borders. Like, Beyond Borders shouldn't have been destroyed.
I know. Like, come on, guys. Beyond
your
Borders
team
had it coming.
Yeah, your team had it coming.
All right. Oh, and it's interesting because something happens in there that we'll talk about next episode. But she goes and says you're going to be you know, working things while we put Emily on suspension, and that's our end point. First off, you should not put JJ in charge of anything. She is not equipped to lead a team, and the problem is there's nobody on the team who is equipped to lead a team.
Emily is
not good at leading a team, and everyone underneath Emily is even worse than she is. Like, none of these people could be trusted to be in charge of this team. So, like, they really should have brought in someone else to run this place. Because none of them are good managers ever. I mean, Hotch wasn't a great manager, but at least he kind of knew what he was doing. A great manager would have frigging stepped in all of the times his team went over the edge, as they did over and over and over again. You know, a great manager would have stepped in and gotten his team members the help they needed, and Hotch never did that because the TV show can't admit that these people need help. But at least he was recognizably a manager in the way that none of these other characters can handle it.
Yeah.
Like, at all. So yeah, it's weird because let's move on to the second episode. No, I'm just saying it's weird because you actually could have done a thing by bringing someone else, a new character, in to lead the team, which could have been an interesting multi-episode arc. But no, instead they do this thing where they're actually following up on last season's ridiculous idea where their Hannibal Lecter character says, "You, JJ, are just as competent as Hotch and should be in charge of the team." And I'm like, "No, she's not. You have badly misread this situation, Hannibal Lecter. You're supposed to be better with people than this."
No, we call him a Hannibal Lecter wannabe because...
That's true. She is. Yeah, she was a Hannibal, Lecter wannabe.
Hannibal would have seen it.
Oh, yeah. Hannibal absolutely would have seen it. And what I love that yeah, it's just a funny thing to remember. All right, please, let's move on to the second episode.
Yeah, let's move on.
Where we get into the Emily stuff, thank God.
Miasma. When local authorities uncover a mass grave in a New Orleans cemetery, the BAU searches for a killer who sees himself as a modern-day plague doctor. Meanwhile, Prentice finds herself forced to endure a hostile interrogation after Barnes suspends her from active duty and summons her for an internal audit.
Ooh. All right. Let's get to it.
Let's start with the regular story and then
let's start with the real, then get into
dream about right.
So
Emily.
I have a couple of questions about the regular story, and you can tell me if I'm overthinking this, underthinking this. Please police my thinking on this, because there's something I didn't understand at all about the episode.
Okay.
So please, if you could explain this to me, I would massively appreciate it. Okay. How do you know that a corpse that has been burned to a crisp had all of its blood drained?
Sorry.
Because we see these bodies and they are basically charcoal. And then we are told by Garcia's report from the ME, that all of these bodies had been completely exsanguinated before being burned.
I have no idea. I can't answer that question.
Yeah, seemed weird to you too, right?
There's a lot about this episode that kind of seems weird. Yeah, but that one was really strange. Like, I'm going, I mean, how do you even, like, start. If they're completely, how would you even, well, I guess you might get some DNA from the teeth.
Oh, no, they're still flesh, but it's burned to a crisp. So, like, they're not skeletons. So you can get DNA from the burned flesh. Absolutely. Like, you can do that, but it's not easy to do. But how do you tell that they've had all of their blood drained?
Maybe. Okay, here. Maybe I've got an answer.
Please.
Maybe if the blood is in the body, you would
it curdles differently
and you would find, and you would in a normal burning, you would find the blood,
curdled in the veins.
It would curdled whatever it would do.
Dried,
you probably would have had that, and nobody found that. Okay, yeah.
That could be right.
Yeah. When I start to think about it, I'm going, so if the blood was in the veins, it would leave, and the blood was in the heart. It would leave some residue that would be blood residue.
That's true. So, but the thing is, even if you stab someone and let all the blood drain out, there's still going to be blood residue in all of their veins and inside their heart. You can't get the blood out of somebody.
Well, you could say that, but there's probably X amount that would be there. Or maybe he hung them up and made sure that they were drained completely.
Maybe he drained them for... maybe he drained them for hours.
But I don't understand why he would drain them, because there would be...
Yeah, the draining part didn't make the most sense, did it?
Because there would be plague stuff in the blood, so wouldn't you want to burn that as well?
Yeah, like, why aren't you just burning the whole body, because you're worried about plague spreading? Infected blood is still dangerous, isn't it? Yeah, you're right.
Ask anybody who's got HIV.
Oh, God, yeah, there you go. They took that stuff incredibly seriously. So yeah, you've got this weird situation where, and again, he goes around killing people, and he grabs this 300 plus pound man.
That's the one that just boggles my mind.
And then later you see the killer, and I'm like, how did he move that guy?
How did he get that guy on a table?
Right? How? How is, no, there's no way.
Maybe he has a forklift somewhere.
Maybe he has a forklift? No. Maybe there's an elaborate hoisting mechanism inside of his warehouse.
Yeah. Plus, if you watch closely at the timeline.
Yeah.
Right? Like I don't know whether the editors had to cut for some time or something. Yeah. But you're going, like, he pulls him in and then the car drives away right away. It's like
how did he overpower this guy?
How did he overpower this? Like, he stuck the stuff into him. Yeah. How did he pull him into the van? And then how did he drive away a split second later?
I know. No, no. You need there to have been more than one person for that scene to work. Well, the part is, right, so the show Dexter is responsible for a lot of terrible things. Because Dexter was a terrible show. But the thing that's it's the worst about it is creating or, like, massively encouraging the myth that there is a drug you can stick in somebody that they will, you know, you can inject into their body and they will immediately just fall over. Right? And they will immediately just be out like a light. And that's just not true. Especially because he's hitting these people with ketamine.
Yeah,
which is, yes,
yeah,
it's a horse
is
tranquilizer.
Not that drug.
And it's powerful. Like, I'm not saying it's a horse tranquilizer and it's powerful. I completely get that. But the idea that sticking this into his neck or arm, he would fall over completely unconscious in enough time for the guy to instantaneously drive away. No, this is a 350-pound man. It's going to take a lot of drugs and a while to knock him out. And he is much physically stronger than the guy who's trying to grapple with him. So, like, I don't understand how he managed to kidnap this guy at all.
Well, because you needed just somebody to get away.
Ah, so it had to be this big guy, because then he could overpower and escape. No,
they never thought.
From a narrative standpoint, yeah, they never thought about the first part of it. You're right.
Yeah, they never thought about getting an actor who was big enough to be able to do all of this so that we wouldn't come up with this stupid complaint.
Yeah. No, like, there's no way to believe that he could have overpowered this man and drugged him and driven away and dragged him. You can't believe it for a second. But you get the fun scene where he escapes.
Yeah.
And he clubs the guy and he steals his van. I'm like, oh, that's so encouraging.
And then he drives, yes, he drives with the ketamine, you know?
Drives while super high on ketamine. Yeah. It's nice, like, you know, it's nice to see a super proactive victim on Criminal Minds. Once in a blue moon.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen much, but when it does, it makes me really happy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really enjoyed that scene. And as usual, they have their theories and they have their questions about motivation, but they literally have no idea or no way to figure out who the killer is until they literally find a bouquet of flowers in the killer's van that has a label on it, and they can just ask people who the flowers were sent to. And so they go to the woman who sent the flowers, and it's like, why didn't they just check who was delivered to? But anyway, maybe she ordered the flowers and brought them herself to the funeral. There you go. But the point is, maybe it wasn't actually delivered to the funeral home, which would have made it too easy. But they talk to the woman, they're like, so who'd you bring the flowers to? And she's like, oh, this woman who died. And she got sick because of mold in the apartment she was living in. Because after Katrina, you know, mold, there was a huge mold problem in all of New Orleans, which there absolutely was. She died because of the mold, and it's very sad, and her son is kind of crazy. And so, boom, you've got your killer right there. No more work is required. She's got a crazy son, and she died of mold. So they go to talk to the guy who ran the mold-based apartment, thinking he might be the target. And then they just arrest the guy without incident once they're there. So, yeah. But it all comes down to they would have had no clue unless they had had essentially... Also, they find all of these drugs in the car, the van, and why can't you just read the label on the drugs?
I didn't understand.
Because it's all the mother's prescriptions.
So they can't find the pharmacy where she bought them, the doctor where she...
had them prescribed, like, the doctor prescribed them? Like, why'd you have to go through the flowers when you got all these prescription bottles? Like, I don't believe that if this guy kept the flowers with a label on them, I don't believe he would carefully remove the labels from all of his mother's medication. They're part of his mementos of his mother's life. So, why would they not have her name and the labels on them? Yeah, it's just a weird thing, and it's like, they want it to be clever that they found the flowers instead of just it being on a prescription label, but there's no reason it shouldn't have been the prescription label. That makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so another questionable choice on the part of the show.
Yeah, this is the woman who wrote Dust and Bones.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, there you go. Another question, just one I'm going to throw at you here.
Okay.
What doctor is this bad at dealing with psychotic patients? Like, this woman runs a medical clinic in the bad part of town.
Yeah.
And this guy is so agitated and so freaked out. How does she not know that her one job in that situation is duck back into the exam room, lock the door, call for help?
Yeah.
Like, why does she try rushing the guy? She's like, I'll rush for the phone on this table or whatever, or a weapon on this table to defend myself. No, just go back, lock the door, you're fine. Like, there's nothing he can do once you've gone back into that room, locked the door, and called for cops. I mean, he set the building on fire, but, you know, you've got plenty of time. There's a sink in that room. You'll be fine. Well, no, okay, that probably wouldn't help that much. But, like, you can call the fire department. You can, I mean, your sprinklers will go off and it'll automatically call the fire department. It's like, no, go and get some help. Like, it's like the doctor. Remember the doctor who found the orderly last season? Pillaging... pillaging the drug thing, the drug cabinet office, and she like charges him. Like, what are the doctors in this world doing that they have no idea how to do? Like, I'm not a doctor, but I know medical professionals, and the medical professionals I've talked to all are taught really, really clear ways of dealing with drug seeking people, of dealing with medical, like, people, drug-seeking people, like desperate criminals, and of dealing with people with severe mental problems. Like, that's kind of a key part of the training these doctors go through. So, to see these doctors, and this is the second time it's happened, who are like, I'll just rush a crazy person who's bigger and stronger than me.
Yeah.
It's insane. Yes. It doesn't make a lick of sense to me. All right.
And I'm not being too hard on this show.
No, you're not. Absolutely, you're not. No, 100%. So, now let's get to the important part. Emily Prentice's interview.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is, you see what I mean? How this whole storyline and this whole part of the episode makes a million times more sense if Emily Prentice shot the guy in New Mexico.
Oh, for sure.
Clearly why this is supposed to be happening.
Well, I would assume it had to be something, because if they were going to do an interrogation about the Spencer Reed thing, they would have already done it.
Exactly. The idea that a year later, you're looking into the Spencer Reed thing.
Except then she goes, and then you have all of those lines about what happened in Roswell.
Yeah.
So that's what it should have been. And they, for whatever reason, had to change. Well, we know why.
Well, no, we know the reason, because they can't have the characters be fallible. They can't allow for the characters to have made a mistake.
Yeah.
Even though they were set up by the killer.
Yeah. And it's Emily's speeches in this thing, right?
Oh, they're insanely bad.
Okay. So she's given these speeches, right? To you know, get mad at Linda Barnes. I'm sorry, but everything Linda Barnes is saying is right.
Yep.
Emily is not controlling her team.
Nope.
She is not handling her team. She is not making sure, because she herself is not following the rules.
Nope.
You know, she's not even pretending to be their boss. She's their best friend that she goes drinking with. That's not how you run a team. Right?
Nope.
But I'm sitting here and wait a minute. Where was it that she told everybody that she was going to take care of them?
Right. Where was that?
Was that in this one, like the team? And she talks to Barnes about her team and how, and I'm sitting here and all I can think is Erica Messer calling everybody together. This is what I mean, where this loss.
This is what you imagine now.
And I could just see Erica Messer, who of course has got the same dark hair and everything as Emily Prentice, right? Is standing in front of her team. No, I've got your backs and I'll be okay here.
This is an external thing. We just have to all hang together.
We gotta hang together and we'll get through this. Yeah. No, honey. It ain't how it works in the real world. Maybe in Criminal Minds world, this is how it works, but it's not in the real world. But all I could do, this one and the next one, like, I'm just sitting there thinking, whoa.
How can you not read this, their persecution at the hands of this woman, calling them out for the many bad decisions they've made?
Yeah.
Right? As a stand-in for the lawyers coming to talk to them about the sexual harassment that was going on.
Because the second guy is getting got fired in early 2018.
Yeah. Like, so, right? I mean, we know it's 2018. We know that the interviews with HR are happening.
Yeah.
We know that they're having to talk to lawyers about this. And then you get this episode where this woman comes in and starts, like, unfairly persecuting the team. And it's like, we can't take back the knowledge that we now have that there was a friggin' lawsuit they were prepping for at this time. And this episode is, like, them attacking the fact that they're being asked to be responsible for the hostile work environment. Yeah. It's crazy, right?
I know, but that's all I could
Like, I hated this episode the first time, just because it was so obvious that there's so many things these characters should be called for account for, and the show is trying to leave them off the hook. But now that you know that there was a lawsuit for sexual harassment going off at the same time, the meta-narrative of this episode is completely transformed.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure. There's absolutely no question. Like, that's all I could think of.
I'm right there with you.
You know? And it was so, I'm going, holy shit.
Yep.
You know? It was just like, why
did you put this, like, why did you put this on the air? How did you think we wouldn't notice that you were trying to make excuses for the behavior of people behind the scenes on your show?
Yeah, but nobody would have known that at the time.
No, but, like, the producers would know.
Yeah.
Like, the people upstairs at CBS would know. Like, there's a famous story in, you know the show Community, right?
Yeah.
So there's an episode that where the character Jeff keeps getting notes in his locker from someone named Kim telling him a bad person. And they end up making a lot of fun of the fact that it's a man and how hilarious it is that a man is named Kim. And so that's just the plot of the episode, and it's a perfectly good episode, nothing wrong with that episode. But what the people upstairs at NBC would be impossible to notice was that the show was constantly getting notes about its content from an executive at NBC who was a man named Kim. So they did an entire episode of the show Community just to give a middle finger to this one executive who they thought was constantly giving them stupid notes on their show, right? And so what I'm saying is, whatever the audience thought of that episode, I just thought it was a cute episode of television. I didn't, but the people upstairs at the network knew what was being said. And my question is, like, what did the people upstairs at the network think of when they were watching this episode, which seems to clearly be about the lawsuit that's going on, the threatened lawsuit that's going on Criminal Minds right now? Like, what was being said about this inside CBS? That's what fascinates me.
Well, it was their defense. And plus, I don't know when the DFEH came into the whole process, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's not clear to me from this filing from the lawsuit, right? The original criminal complaint.
Yeah, but from the criminal complaint, we know that there was a multi-year investigation and arbitration process.
Yes, and the DFEH, right, is all of the this just to add to this, right? Although we should save it for other things, they're all women except I don't know Soyeon. I have no is a staff counsel, but all the chief counsel and the two senior staff counsels in this complaint, right, are all women.
So you're saying that in addition to everything else that suggests that this episode is more meaningful than it first seems, the lawyers who were coming to interview everybody about this were all women?
Well, yeah.
Damn. Okay.
Now, I don't know, as I said, I don't know if the DFEH, these women, had been interviewing some of these people, but this has been multi, so they'd obviously been in talks once this started, because these two people had their own lawsuits, but must have brought it to DFEH, and then DFEH figured they had enough to do this because
so they we don't know. Yeah, we don't know exactly when that came in, but
like the timeline.
It's an interesting footnote to this whole thing.
Well, it's when I was listening to, when I was listening to this defense and just going, "Oh, so that's what your defense is going to be?"
Well, and it's crazy. It's legit crazy watching this episode because again, the team is wrong. That Steven is dead. Like they're right. Steven is dead. Because Emily walked their team into an ambush.
Yeah, and no, and that's the one thing Linda Barnes is not allowed to say.
Yeah.
You walked them into an ambush. You should have called,
and you should have let Tactical handle this. You should have flown in with helicopters or done anything. But you full-on knew that Scratch had set up a trap for you.
Yeah.
And you drove into the trap knowing that it was a trap.
Yeah. You set the trap up, and Emily's saying this, right?
Yes. And she's trying to defend it. We couldn't have known. It's not our fault that Steven died. It's absolutely your fault Steven died. There's no question. She, his wife should be suing the FBI.
Yep.
Them breaking all FBI procedures because they were, let's face it, horny to kill Scratch themselves is what got Steven killed. I probably shouldn't describe it that way, but that's how they all felt. They all had a personal involvement. They all had a, personal motivation for wanting to get Scratch themselves, and their excitement to go get Scratch themselves and not wait around for the people who were trained to do takedowns to handle it, right? That is what got Steven killed. Her desire for personal revenge on Scratch. Now, I want you to imagine something, because this is something I brought up before. Imagine the stakes of this scene if, in addition to all of this, she has shot the guy in New Mexico, right? So that would increase the stakes. But here's the real stakes I want to talk about. What if the thing I pitched at the end of last season is true, and she's also covering for the fact that Spencer Reed actually did kill Nady Ramos, and they're covering it up. Mm-hmm. Imagine if that was added into this whole thing, how much more resonant all of this would be and how much more terrifying this would all be for the characters.
Yeah.
It's just a better twist for the story in every respect if he actually did kill that woman being brainwashed. But yeah, it's a much better way to take the story, but they can't see that. Because, again, they can't allow their characters to be questioned ever. Mm-hmm. And that's what's, I think, maybe the most frustrating thing about the show, is that they can't ever admit their characters have done anything wrong, even when they demonstrably did.
Yep.
So yeah, I guess what we're trying to say here is, the Emily interview scene is a lot. It is a lot to take.
Yeah, and it's and Barnes is fully justified in suspending her.
Yeah, but they act like, she's just a grasping, career-hungry woman who's desperate to get to the top of the FBI.
Well, right? Yeah, I know, but I don't think that Erica Messer can see herself that way.
No, of course not.
So, Barnes is, as Barnes says to Prentice, there's a lot of you and me. There's a lot of me and you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, for sure. But Barnes plays by the rules. You may not like it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there may not, but I mean, they're creating this monstrous character in Barnes.
Yep.
So let's move on to Annihilator because we get more Barnes.
Oh, we do. We get, and it goes nuts this time.
Yeah. So now
it goes crazy.
Oh, by the way, we are now adding basically, still, we don't have any sexual components to these crimes.
Crimes, that's true. Yeah, once again. Although, more with this one, but even this one, but we'll talk about it as we get there. Go.
Okay, Annihilator. With Prentice still suspended and Reed refusing to work without her, Barnes takes the lead and joins the remaining members of the BAU as they search St. Louis, Missouri for the perpetrator of a quadruple homicide. Meanwhile, Reed attempts to dissuade Prentice from making a bold decision.
Yeah, Okay, so yeah, perfectly good description of the plot. Let's get into it. So first off, I'm going to say what I always say when they describe something this way. This isn't a family annihilator. Family annihilator is a person who, because they can't deal with being revealed to be actually incompetent, right? The person whose entire self-worth is wrapped up in how their family sees them, and when they fail at whatever, they murder their whole family so they don't have to deal with the public shame of being revealed to not be perfect. That's what a family annihilator is. It's a well-known thing. It's a real thing. It's John List was a family annihilator. It's an actual serious psychological condition and a well-known motive for serial killers. This has nothing to do with that.
Nothing.
This isn't a family, and the killer is from outside who is murdering everybody because he thought they were in the way of his love for this woman.
Yes. Okay. Now, the thing is, they do not call the episode Family Annihilator. No, they just call it Annihilator, right?
But the characters refer to it as a Family Annihilator.
Anyway.
Yes. I just think it's worth mentioning that the show always gets the term Family Annihilator wrong. The only time they didn't, and I assume they used it in this episode, I haven't gone back and checked,
is in
The Fox, where a guy was making it look like a family annihilators were murdering their whole family, but really he was just a regular serial killer.
Let's get to it.
I just wanted to mention the problem with the term family annihilator.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
that I really had.
And you always have it. It's because.
I do.
But it just goes to the fact that nobody really thinks these shows through. You can tell that it is now very much episodic. People are not even trying to sort of figure out what's going on anymore. They're not doing any research, not real research, you know. We've got the idea that this is just these are all each one-offs, and
completely unconcerned in that respect.
Yeah. And so they find this guy, he's being killed, you know, they have your red herring.
They're like, oh, a guy was just kicked out of the building, so he might be the guy. And then they find him suffocated in his car with a suicide note taped to the wheel. And Barnes is depicted as being so awful at her job. She's like, well, I guess that wraps up that one. I guess we should all just go home. I'm like, what? She's happy to just go home without doing any final investigation whatsoever, seeing if there's any evidence that this guy did it. And luckily, by the time they had arrived at the crime scene, we already find out that there's no drugs in the guy's system, so it wasn't a suicide. But it's like, the fact that she was so ready to just go home makes her look cartoonishly bad at her job.
Yeah. No, this is, yeah, they're making her a cartoon character.
Yeah.
Like,
it's crazy.
It's to make the team all look good, and the team all hate her, and they're all suspicious of her, and they're all absolutely sure, right, that they're, that she is evil incarnate, and she is given all of her lines and everything. I mean, she plays it well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what does she care? She's an actress.
Yeah, but job's a job.
A job's a job, but in the context of the show and this whole episode, nobody who has made her way to be the executive director, first of all, would go into the field FBI, would go into the field like that. But that aside, when she went into the field, she knows what she's doing, or she wouldn't be the, because you can have a director of the FBI that comes from outside and might not know, but everybody underneath.
She worked her way up through the FBI.
Yes. Through the ranks. She knows how to do all of this stuff. So to create this cartoonish bad boss, or the powers that be within the system are against this team who does such wonderful work and never does anything wrong. I know. I mean, I if we were to talk about anything, I just get so fed up now. I'm just so fed up. I'm getting to the end of this. We're now 2 years worth of episodes left.
Yeah, in the whole show.
In the whole show. But this is so bad. But you're right. It would have made more sense if Emily had to shoot the guy.
Yeah. Her presence there suddenly makes sense.
It makes
people questioning Emily suddenly makes sense. Like,
yeah,
all of the characters' motivations make so much more sense if she shot that guy in New Mexico.
Yeah, and here I cannot cope with the Prentice Reed interaction in this episode.
Oh, it's insane.
It's just like you're sitting there going, oh, please. I just want to cry. I just want to cry. I watched the episode and I just want to cry.
I'm right there with you.
And I'm going, no, I know why. Prentice knows she did something wrong.
Yep.
And for once, you see, this is where you're getting this shift now, as you say, when they're trying to butch up Reed. Reed is the one that is taking Emily off the hook.
Yep. Letting her off the hook. She did something wrong. She's willing to accept the responsibility and take a bullet for the team. And he comes in and says, no, you can't take responsibility for your actions.
Yeah.
And he doesn't say it in those words.
But that's what he does.
That's what he means.
And she's willing to, for the first time.
Yeah.
She knows that was the first time she's done something that was seriously wrong, deleting that with the support of two of her team members. Yep. It wasn't like she was alone doing that.
Nope.
And, you know, but she's going to bite the bullet. She's going to take it. She's going to go back to Interpol and back to London. Mm-hmm. Right? Because she did something terribly wrong and she knows it. And then, so it's up to Reed, who is now becoming Mr. Serious, to let her off the hook.
And now he's the one reinforcing the team's belief that they should never suffer the consequences of their actions.
Yeah. Well, he's never.
That's how he's lived his life.
Well, he's taking his cue from the rest of his team members.
Yep.
Who have let him off the hook all the time.
Over and over again.
And this is now his family, you know, because he's never really had a family other than his mother. Mm-hmm. So, friends.
Family or friends.
Yeah. So this is everything. Yeah,
this is everything to him, these people. So of course he's not going to let the team break up.
However.
Yeah.
The team.
We'll talk about that next week.
No,
and it's interesting. So, it does happen at the end of this episode.
Happens at the end of this episode.
But we'll talk about it. I'm just saying, I'm so excited to get to the first episode next week for reasons I'll talk about in a minute. But for right now, let's just wrap up. Before we talk more about Emily and Reed, let's just wrap up the plot of this episode. And the plot of this episode is, again, it's kind of bonkers. So they find the guy, and this is kind of crazy. So one of the would-be victims was at her sister's house the night of the murder. And she was dating the guy who got framed for the crime, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this really weird scene where Barnes does 100% the right thing, and everyone accuses her of being a monster.
Yeah.
She says, you can't tell her boyfriend is dead, because we have to find out if she knows the killer is. This is a timeline. The killer's still out there. He might be about to kill again. We need a name, and if she emotionally shuts down on us, that could take hours before we get that name. And everyone acts like she's a monster for saying that.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Barnes's plan of ensuring that she doesn't emotionally shut down 100% works. They get the name of the killer immediately.
Yeah, it's exactly...
She was completely right
to say...
Don't shut her down. Don't risk her shutting down emotionally. Get the name, then we can worry about her emotional state.
Yeah.
She was right. And the thing is, Tara, right? Tara.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Acts like she's a monster for saying that. She's like, don't ever order me. Like, don't ever tell me how to deal with a witness again. Like, don't ever tell me how to do an interview. And I'm like, she was 100% right in everything she ordered you to do. And you saved a woman's life because of it.
Yeah. And furthermore, right? Yeah. Furthermore, what, as I said, what does it serve to tell this girl that he's dead? He's going to be dead 10 minutes from now, 20 minutes from now, half
an
hour from now.
He's going to be dead for the rest of eternity. You need to find out who the killer is
and
now.
Give her 5 minutes of peace, because she's going to find out soon enough. It's not like this was, there had to be something come down on high to say that all of these people in the BAU have to be seen as perfect.
Yeah.
And everybody else is wrong.
And that's when we get to the dumbest scene in the episode. Because here's the thing. Everything Barnes said about Emily last week was correct.
Yes.
Everything. Everything about Emily's bad management, everything about her breaking the rules, everything about her covering up crimes, all of it was 100% correct.
Yeah.
Everything. This episode, like, wanting to take the case, she was right too. It's an interesting case that's worth taking.
Yeah.
She was wrong to just, like, not wait on the autopsy before announcing that this guy is definitely a killer and to go home. But she was 100% right that they needed to get the information from the woman immediately and couldn't wait for her to have an emotional breakdown. Right? She was 100. And then, so Emma Barnes has been surprisingly reasonable and dead on about everything so far. So at the end of the episode, they need to invalidate all of her opinions by having her do the dumbest thing a fictional character has maybe ever done. What is that scene? Tell me what that scene is, because I don't know what that scene is. She's like, oh, well, what I've got to do is get this, like, a guy. Okay, the first thing they teach you in hostage rescue, or with any dealing with any kind of a person who's threatening suicide and blah, 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 right? Who's got a gun, threatening to kill himself. The first thing they teach you, and this is, by the way, in case you want know, do the people who wrote this know this? It's literally like the second chapter of Mindhunter, okay?
Yeah.
The first thing you do is, whatever the person with the gun asks you to do, don't do it.
Yeah.
If they ask you for someone, it's because they're going to kill that person. Every FBI agent knows this. And then you have this ridiculous thing where Barnes says to justify bringing him, you brought the wife to see the werewolf man. And I'm like, yeah, they did, because he was a werewolf man living in a cave, and he was no threat to anyone. He didn't have a gun. If he had charged his wife, they could have just shot him. This is a very different situation.
Yeah.
A man has a gun, and he's probably there to kill that woman, and her plan is, bring the woman to talk to him.
Like, but what? That's because they're defending the team.
I know. They have to completely invalidate this woman.
All these things. Plus, I'm sure that the writers by year 13 don't have to go and read Mindhunter before they write for this show.
Yeah, you're probably.
So, you know. But
maybe they literally just don't know.
Yeah, but that's okay. But Barnes would have known better. It makes no sense, except that they want him, Barnes.
They want to invalidate the character. No, they want to invalidate the character.
Yes. Yes.
Barnes. They want to make it so the character can be dismissed by the audience. So they have her do something that is unaccountably stupid and completely out of character for anyone. And her motivation is that this is taking too long? Like, they had been pointing a gun at him for 30 seconds. Like, do you know how long it takes to deal with hostage situations? Hours,
days
sometimes. Sometimes weeks.
And but she's the executive director of the FBI, and she knows about, she's been hostage in situations. Hostage situations.
Of course she does. She's studied. She's provided oversight for this. There's no way this character doesn't know how long this kind of thing can take. And the idea that within 30 seconds, she's like, oh, well, now I should just go and give the killer exactly what he wants, thus endangering a woman's life. Like, what is happening here? And I mean, we both said it because we know what's happening here. They have to invalidate this woman's position. They have to do a character assassination on this woman in order to prop up their team. And that's the most insulting part, because it's like, they come so close to self-awareness. This is a show about a team that has screwed up over and over and over again. And so what they decide to do is, and this is what's so sickening, they're like, what we can do is, we'll have a character call them out on all their crap, but then we will sabotage that character and make that character into a monster, so the audience dismisses all of the completely valid complaints about the team while they're busy dismissing this woman.
Yep.
And it's kind of disgusting that they did it, and it plays really terrible for the audience. I mean, it did for me, and I know it did for you. Who knows how the regular, like the regular viewing audience who has not spent many years of their lives thinking about Criminal Minds and story structure thinks about it.
Yeah, but, I know it.
It's just, this scene is so frustrating. All right. It's just, they have her do the dumbest thing in the world just so that they can we can dismiss her perfectly reasonable complaints about the team. I guess that's what sickens me the most here. It's like, Barnes is right about everything.
Yep.
And the show character assassinates her. And the fact that they created a character just so her character could be assassinated kind of disgusts me a little.
Well, yeah, but that's, you know, as far as disgusting things about this show.
Okay,
yeah,
you're right. It's pretty low on the list.
It's, you know, now that we're getting, it's low on the list. Yeah. I mean, but you're watching this, right?
Yeah.
And is this how the entire production team and the actors and everybody else justified?
Yeah. Well, you know, people just don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Oh, well, and the other thing that I did check out is, when did the Anthony Rapp thing with Kevin Spacey
come out? Start, when was that?
It started October 2017.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So yeah. Well, while this was all happening.
Yeah, because there's only one guy that's been so far fired, and then the other guy gets fired.
That's fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, but I was wondering about that because I was wondering.
Because Anthony Rapp is a big thing because it was the first. Anthony Rapp and Terry Crews were the only male same-sex complainants about this kind of harassment or exploitation.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, who knows?
That's interesting.
We don't know who it was who sexually assaulted Terry Crews.
Oh, no, we do. It was a powerful agent.
Oh, who was it? Okay.
It was a powerful agent, and that's why Terry Crews was terrified about bringing it up, because he was worried it would destroy his career.
And you have to wonder about, because what this puts into my head too is wondering about Shamar Moore's world.
Yeah, situation. Ooh, that's fascinating too. Although we're not going to speculate too much into that one. But yeah, so to refocus on the episode.
Yeah, let's go back.
It's an unbelievably frustrating episode, just for the reason that you brought in this woman last week to, like, really stick it to the team and really make us question, are they doing the right thing? Are they good at their job? Should this be preserved and defended? And then you did this episode so you wouldn't have to address the problems brought up last week. That's what's so disgusting about it. And as you said, to make the thing come full circle, and for Spencer Reed to become the avatar of not taking responsibility for your actions.
Yeah.
You know,
It was a terrible episode from this. Yeah. At least At least I am no longer blaming Scientology for the bad ethics of this show. It's clear that these are bad people.
Yeah. No, it goes much deeper.
Yeah. And I mean, anyway, yeah, we'll...
It's frustrating, yeah. And you are right to be frustrated.
So...
Okay, so...
I just want to say, remember, she has, of all things, left JJ in charge of the two guys.
I know. How crazy is that?
I mean, the only thing that coming up that's pretty funny is watching Penelope try to fit into a different
area. Well, we're going to talk about that in a second. All right. Next week is the episode I'm most excited to talk about all season, and I'll tell you why. So I think I've mentioned here once or twice my love of the TV show CSI Miami.
Yes.
And I am the first person to have, been a proponent of the theory. I'm the creator of the theory that every single person who was working on CSI Miami, except for the actors, thought they were making a comedy. And they thought it would be better if they didn't tell the actors it was a comedy, because then they might mug or overplay things. They're like, no, we have to let the people who are starring in the show just be ridiculous and read these terrible lines with a straight face, because it will be funnier that way. And I would argue it absolutely was funnier that way. If you think of it as a comedy, it is a hilarious show. Like, it is legit very funny to watch if you have that in your head. And here's the thing that kind of bolsters my opinion. I believe that there is a good chance that Adam Rodriguez knew how absurd CSI Miami was, and knew he was making a comedy. And my evidence for that is the next episode of television, which is the only episode, like, I don't know if it's the first episode of television he's directed, but Adam Rodriguez directed the next episode of Criminal Minds. And it is both one of the most unpleasant murder stories they've ever done, but at the same time, it is an attempt to do hilarious comedy on Criminal Minds. And we are 13 years in, and this is the first time there has been a comedy episode of Criminal Minds. And that kind of blows my mind.
Yeah, and he directs it. So we've got Last Gasp, The Capilanos, and The Dance of Love.
Yeah, so Last Dance is the one I'm talking about. It is the first comedy episode in the history of Criminal Minds. They will do one more comedy episode in the 15th season. But it is the first ever comedy episode of Criminal Minds. Because
you mean
Last Gasp, not Last Dance. Sorry, yeah. Last Gasp is, like I said, the first ever comedy episode of Criminal Minds, which is kind of amazing. The Capilanos is Matt Gubler's second last episode he directed, I believe. Because how did he not direct an episode in the final season? I don't get it. But he didn't. So it's the second, I believe it's the second last Matt Gubler episode ever, which is tragic because, well, we'll talk about the episode next week. Yeah. It's nothing special. And then, what is the last one? I don't remember what the last one is.
Dance of Love. Two women in Chicago, Illinois are stabbed to death on consecutive nights and found with a red rose in their mouths. And then Joe Mantegna is Rossi takes personal time off. After getting a call from his third ex-wife, Crystal.
Oh, okay. Is it weird that I still don't remember which episode, like, women stabbed with roses in their mouths? Like, which episode is this? Oh, is this the one about the DJ?
Yeah, actually, I think it is.
It's the DJ. Okay, it's the DJ episode. Jason Gedrick. Right. Okay, all right. Now I never remember. Yeah, I guess... my takeaway from those episodes was not the rose. I guess there was a rose every time, but the fact that every single person had a different music themed thing left around there in the way they were killed. I guess I forgot that the women were stabbed. All right, so yeah, that should be a fun one next week, just because I'm so it's going to be interesting talking about Matt Gubler making a meh episode again, and how his, like, maybe, like, we're going to do a lot of theorizing, I'm sure, about what behind the scenes is keeping Matt Gubler from being able to stretch his artistic legs the way he used to. But that can be something we address then. For now, I'm going to say, remember to watch those episodes before next week so you can join us in appreciating them? Don't know why that became a question. But no, yeah, join us back here for that. That should be a ton of fun. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any profiling-related fiction you'd like us to check out, please drop us a line at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. So we will see you back here next Thursday for that. I guess we're done with people listening to us talk about Beyond Borders, so hopefully by now you understand why Beyond Borders completely broke us emotionally and forced us to take a week and a half off of Criminal Minds.
Only to have to do this season.
I know, right? Doesn't get any better than here.
Post-lawsuit!
It's crazy. It's legit bonkers. All right, so I hope you will join us back here next week for the new episodes, and wait until you see what we have for between this season. But until then, I'm going to say, that's right, au revoir.
And have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.